Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask Unity podcast, episode 73. For those of you new to the show, I'm comedian Simon Kane, and this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people for the worlds of stand-up, radio, writing, and today, TV. Chris Sussman is the recently appointed head of comedy at BBC Studios, which means he's uniquely positioned to look at the current and future output of comedy, but not just at the BBC, but on other channels as well, as BBC Studios moves from an in-house operation to a commercial one. We talked about what a typical day looks like for him, if the BBC should be responsible for working to not cause offence in its viewers, his take on Netflix and other on-demand services, and so much more. I think this podcast would be great for anyone looking to try and sell their idea into the BBC, as well as a writer looking to get their work seen by the right people who work in telly. As always, any thoughts or opinions Chris gives are his own and are not representative of the BBC, so please always be mindful of that. If you're new here, please do hit that subscribe button. If you're old here, please do think about giving us an honest review in iTunes. Before I forget, quick plug for some of the things I'm working on personally outside of podcasting. If you are in Leicester and you would like to see a work-in-progress version of my new show, which is called Laughter is the Best Placebo, at 9 p.m. at The Exchange. It's a free show, so pay what you want on exit, and it would really be nice to meet some of you there. Also, the day before that, in Leicester, at Pat's Pizzeria, I'm doing our third live Q&A podcast with a bunch of Midlands promoters. So if you would like to come down to that, if you're a performer, a comedian, a person who wants to get into comedy, a person who wants to get into promoting, any of those things, please look up the details. They're in the Facebook group and they're on my website. Please come down and support. Both of them are free entry, and the podcast one actually isn't a donation thing at all. So if you want to donate, you have to do it on my website. Additional to that, my LGBTQ night is running in London on the 12th of February at Angel Comedy Club, and there are still a few tickets left at the Bill Murray, so please come down if you can make it. Like I said, there aren't a massive amount of tickets left, but it would be great if it could sell out. So if you can afford £5 to come down and support that, that'd be great. If you want to know more about that night, check it out on my website. All the details are there. Thank you. But now, without any more delays, this is Chris Sussman.
So I'm Chris Sussman. I'm head of comedy at BBC Studios, which means I look after the comedy production that the BBC makes, which means that essentially I look after all of the production that is made in-house at the BBC, which is roughly sort of 40 to 50% of all the comedy, scripted comedy that is made at the BBC, both TV and radio, which is about 80% of the radio, which means I look after the department that makes everything, get involved in scripts, in casting, in editing. Yeah, I sort of do it all, really.
And what's your relationship like, but also what's your relationship with the writer's room?
I don't have a huge relationship with the writer's room. I mean, I should point out, I started this job about 6 months ago. I haven't had much to do with the writer's room. So I sort of had a weird dual path when I started out. I started in TV production. So my first job was as a runner on The Big Breakfast at Planet 24, and sort of worked my way up in the entertainment side of things as a sort of runner, researcher, assistant producer, producer, series producer, exec, etc. Doing mostly sort of entertainment shows and comedy entertainment stuff. And then at the same time, I was writing comedy with a friend. I was sort of deluded into thinking I might be a good comedy writer quickly discovered that I wasn't, having written a few sketches on some sketch shows like Monkey Dust, Peter Serafinowicz's show, Manstroke Woman, also wrote three series of a Radio 4 sitcom. And those two worlds sort of collided when I got a job at the BBC doing comedy commissioning, which I did for 5 years, and then I got this job.
Okay, what does a typical day look like for you then?
There is probably no such thing as a typical day, if that doesn't sound too cliched. Some days I will be out on set, visiting sets, seeing stuff filmed. Some days I'll be in the edit. Some days I'll be in the office reading scripts. A lot of meetings, I would say. My life is probably 70% meetings, you know, with writers, with producers, with directors, etc. But I'm very lucky, you know, I genuinely love my job. It's a rare day when I wake up in the morning and there's not something that I'm looking forward to, I'd say.
That's pretty nice.
Yeah, lucky me.
Yeah. And in terms of you finding ideas for shows, what's the process of them, A, getting in front of you, in terms of like how many layers and how many different types of people does that go through? And what's the process of it going from you to, say, BBC production or in the production house for the BBC for another channel? Because I know that's the point of...
Yeah, well, we're not doing any of that yet. So that'll be next year. So at the moment, we just make stuff for the BBC.
Right.
So in terms of the process of ideas, you know, I have a brilliant team here of great development producers and execs in both radio and TV. I guess they do a large amount of the filtering for me. You know, they read a lot of scripts, work out projects that they like themselves, and when they get something to a stage that, you know, they're really, where it's something they're really keen on, then they'll bring it to me and we'll have a chat about it, and I guess either I'll like it or not, but, you know, I try and, you know, back people and support the stuff that they really like and they're really passionate about. And then there's sort of some projects that I just develop, I guess, directly myself. You know, I guess the good thing about coming to this job from the commissioning job is that I had some, you know, relationships with writers that I really liked. So when I started here, was instantly able to kick off some developments with people that I really wanted to work with and bring into BBC Studios.
I've sort of got two questions from the back of that then.
Okay.
I suppose I'll start with this one. If a cynical comedian was listening to this who had an idea for a show,
yeah,
or a script,
yeah,
and felt like the BBC is a bit tied up in the terms of the agencies of comedians that, you know, like Avalon or PBJ or, yeah, any of the big ones,
yeah,
and as a result doesn't feel like they can get through, what would be your response to something like that?
Well, I guess my first response would say that there are, you know, thousands and thousands of people that want to write for TV and for radio, and there's only a limited number of slots. So inevitably there are going to be people that are going to be disappointed and frustrated and think the process doesn't work. But ultimately, as I said, there's a limited number of slots, so there has to be some sort of filtering mechanism. The agents sort of act as a filtering mechanism for us, because if stuff comes to us through an agent, we know that it has had someone has thought about it and likes it and is passing it on to us for a reason. And, you know, there are certain agents that you will work with and you will learn to trust their tastes, or at least you think they've got similar tastes to you. So when they send you something, you think, oh, that's interesting. If they like it, then there's a good chance that I might like it as well. I wouldn't say we have any particular relationships with any agencies, so it's not like we just make Avalon shows. I work with a huge number of writers from all sorts of different agencies, from Casarotto and Independent and United and Curtis Brown. I mean, my first advice to any, you know, new writer wanting to get their scripted comedy onto TV or onto radio would be to get an agent. So I think, you know, that is an unavoidable step.
Okay, so how many independent comedians would you say you work with at the moment?
When you say comedians, do you mean writers?
Writers or
performers?
Yeah, should we stick with the label of writer rather, sure, than comedian? Because
I mean, obviously we work with comedians, so we've just got, you know, a Johnny Vegas thing commissioned, for instance, on BBC One, but he's a comedian who's in it,
yeah,
and it's being written by two other writers.
Okay.
Then we have projects like Sunny D, which is written by Dane Baptiste, who is a comedian.
Mm.
So I guess it depends whether you just mean how many comedians we're working with or whether you're talking specifically about the writing.
I see what you're saying. Let's say, how many independent freelance performers are you working with at the moment?
Well, everyone's independent and freelance.
Oh, okay. No, I'm talking about... All right, let's do it another way. People who don't have representation, how many of those do you work with on a regular basis?
I don't know, but I suspect it would be extremely small, because when... we make something, we have to do contracts with people, so they have to have agents and representation. So it's very rare to work with someone who represents themselves. I mean, I would not advise any writer or comedian to represent themselves.
So in many ways, it's not necessarily the agent being a shortcut to getting on. It's just a case of logistically, they're easier to work with in a way because they've got someone who knows how to negotiate that for them.
Well, it's both, I would say. You know, this industry is about having people fighting your corner, whether that's a producer that really champions you to a broadcaster, or a commissioner who really champions you to the head of BBC One. You need an agent who's really going to champion you to production companies and is going to fight to get the best deal for you when those production companies want to work with you. Yeah.
Okay. When you're looking for TV shows and when you're after something, I remember in that interview I was talking to you about before we started, you said the next big thing is always the thing that surprises you.
Yeah.
It's not something you can predict trend-wise.
I think that's true, yeah.
And in the case of the way that a lot of comedians sort of badmouth comedy on TV now is they'll sort of go, oh, look, Mrs. Brown's Boys won, whatever. They're never going to want my adventurous comedy about, you know, snakes and ladders or something like that,
yeah.
Right? So how would you say you're surprised in a general comedy sense? Like, what surprises you?
Well, Mrs. Brown's Boys is hugely surprising. I mean, people always point to that. People should not underestimate, I would say. I mean, I should point out, I had nothing to do with it, you know, getting commissioned and becoming a success. I can't claim anything on that. But the people that did, that was a hugely brave decision to put on primetime BBC a man dressed up as a woman who swears a lot. You know, it would be very easy to have dismissed that. And yet it is by far and away the most successful comedy for years and years and years. You know, we did a live special earlier this summer, which got 11.5 million people watching it. You know, in compared to today's ratings, it's as big as Sherlock, it's as big as Downton Abbey, it's as big as Doctor Who. It does a tremendous amount for comedy in terms of, you know, boosting the profile of the comedy industry. But that's just one thing. You know, there are a huge number of channels making huge variety of comedy. So right at the other spectrum, you've got Fleabag on BBC Three.
Love that show.
which a lot of people in the comedy industry, I would say, you know, are much more positive about than something like Mrs. Brown's Boys. But it is a very different type of show. So I think it would be silly to point at comedy and go, oh, only stuff like Mrs. Brown's Boys gets on, when you've clearly got, you know, you've got Fleabag at one end, you've got Mrs. Brown's Boys at the other, and you've got everything in between. You know, there's hundreds of different types of shows.
I suppose also something that I always, I don't say yell at, but I get really frustrated when I'm talking to a comedian who says something like this, is does your idea fit the channel you're trying to get it on? Because half the time, I don't necessarily feel like it would.
Yeah.
Or I feel like they want it on a certain, like they want it on the BBC for the coolness of the BBC.
Yeah.
When it might work better on Dave because it's a panel show format or something like that. And so I suppose, are there any specific branding ideas or specific things that different channels are looking for that you're after?
Well, A, I'm a seller, I'm not a buyer. So I you know, I make shows and I sell ideas to the BBC, to the channels and the commissioning team. I only do scripted comedy, so I can't speak for, you know, pure stand-up or panel shows or comedy entertainment ideas. But what I would say to anyone is, look at how many channels there are that make stuff these days. If you can't find one to make the show that you've written or that you really want to make, maybe it's time to have another idea, or maybe it's time to write something else. Because I genuinely believe that if your show is really great and there is a market for it, then you will find it somewhere, that you will find a channel wanting to put it on.
And you said that you're a seller of ideas, essentially.
Yeah.
And obviously you mentioned that the numbers of viewership figures are going down on TV.
Yeah.
Or they're not on the steady incline that they might have been before.
Yeah.
How are you finding selling ideas has changed for you then? Is it a case of you now have to just pitch and say it'll hit a million users or a million, million people instead of...
No, you never have those sorts of conversations. I think it's very hard, you know, when you're doing this to try and second guess how successful something is going to be. Nobody would have second guessed that Mrs. Brown's Boys would have got 11.5 million. You know, when The Office came along, no one would have predicted that was going to be a hit. And in fact, it wasn't a hit until the second series. That's what I think I mean when about you know, the next big hit is surprising, because you just don't know what it's going to be. So no, you can't. There's no point trying to sell something and say it's going to get this X number of viewers or listeners. You just don't know. So all you can do is go on your instincts and you sell it by saying, here's a script, I really love it, I hope you do too.
Because when I spoke to Ian Coyle at Dave, he was telling me that he's essentially an ad man rather than a commissioner, because the channel's funded by advertising.
Right.
He has to sell it and say, we think we'll be able to sell an advert in the middle of this for this brand that will cover, you know, the costs of making it, kind of thing. What is a sales pitch look like for you? Like, say, what's the, so that Johnny Vegas, can we talk about that Johnny Vegas
show? Yeah, of course, yeah.
Was that your sell?
No. I mean, I was, the pilot had already been commissioned when I started this job.
Okay.
There was a producer called, exec called Rebecca Papworth, who in fact produced that pilot, and it, you know, it was something that she worked up with Johnny, and she got the writers involved, and you know, it was a real passion project for her. I think in a way comedy is the easiest thing in the world to try and sell, because as I said, you just do it via a script that you love. So for me, selling is no more complicated really than going to you know, the head of comedy commissioning at the BBC and giving him a script that I really love and saying, please read this. And sometimes you do a bit more, sometimes you try and package it up. You know, you'll attach some cast, you'll attach a great director, you might do some additional work, like look at what a series might look like, but really ultimately it comes down to the writing.
So people wouldn't send a script to you, they would send it to where, or would they send it direct to you?
Yeah, sometimes people send scripts to me, agents will send me a script.
Right, and in case of, because you said there are certain layers to go through sometimes to get to you.
I don't think I said that.
Oh, sorry.
No, I think what I said is that, you know, I have a team,
okay,
all of whom will be working up projects, and they'll be filtering stuff out themselves and bringing them to me. But people still bring stuff to me directly as well, yeah.
Well, no, I was only trying to segue slightly, because I read an article, and I don't know how true it was, because it was on the Daily Mail, so I don't know how much I trust it, but it was where you were talking about, and I don't want to misquote you, but you were talking about the levels of hierarchy that a gag needs to go through now at the BBC.
Okay, yeah, well, yes, that was misquoted,
okay,
unsurprisingly, it being in the media. Secondly, that was a comment that I made when I was doing an entirely different job.
Right.
So that's when I was in commissioning. Now, what I said then, that was during a BAFTA, I was sitting on a BAFTA panel talking about offence in comedy, and there was a Q&A at the end, and someone asked me, what has been the hardest joke you've ever had to try and get put on air? And I said, which was obviously cut out, that actually I think, you know, in my 5 years of commissioning, I found the compliance process pretty easy, and there weren't a lot of things that I wasn't allowed to say, or that, you know, I had to say to the shows that I was working on, you can't say that. Most of the time, you know, particularly if something's funny, you're allowed to get away with it. I mean, you look at something like Fleabag, you know, where I think the Times called it the filthiest show that had ever been on TV, which I would slightly dispute. But, you know, I think a lot of people might be surprised that that would be on the BBC because of, you know, some quite strong sort of sexual content in it. But no, with that one, so I just gave a very specific example of a joke that was quite sensitive and had to go all the way up to the Director General. But that was a very, very rare example, a very rare exception. Most of the time, I would say the process is pretty simple.
I mean, given humour is so subjective,
yeah,
and it comes down to the context of the way you're doing it and,
yeah,
and everything around it. When you're trying to, well, on the rare times that you are trying to say to someone, this is actually quite funny,
yeah,
has there ever been a time where the other person has been like, I don't find this funny?
In what do you mean? Do you mean in terms of like pitching an idea, or are you talking specifically about like offence and compliance and stuff?
So specifically an idea. So say you had a show idea or a show that you were trying to put through, and the person that you were taking it to, whichever channel commissioner it was, goes, I don't see why this, I love your opinions on stuff, but I just don't see why this is funny.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you just have to deal with that. I mean, ultimately, you know, the commissioning team, they have a job, and their job, again, you know, it's a similar thing in terms of they're getting pitched hundreds of ideas from lots of different production companies. They can't put them all, so they have to make decisions. So they make their decision, you just have to accept it. You know, and you sometimes you'll argue back. If there's something you're really passionate about, you'll argue back more. But it's very rare, I think, you'll win that battle if they don't find it funny and you do. There's not a lot you can do, you know.
Mm. And I suppose the culture of offence in general is something that's quite, I wouldn't say a hot topic, but it's something that has been covered quite a lot in comedy.
Yeah.
In terms of, is it the BBC's responsibility to shield people from stuff that might offend them? Or, you know, even things like the watershed, like, is that too early now still because people are going to bed later? And, you know, what's your opinion on how that stuff's changing and how offence is being taken or...
Yeah, well, it's a very, very complicated issue, isn't it? And I think the answer is there are no blanket rules. You take every case, every joke, you look at it and you make a decision on it. Sometimes you say, yeah, that's going to offend people, that's what we want it to do. You know, that's the point of that joke. And it's a clever joke. And within the context of the program that it's going to go in, that's fine. So, you know, I worked on shows with people like Harry Enfield and Charlie Brooker and Frankie Boyle. And, you know, they sail close to the wind sometimes, but that's what you want them to do. And there's an audience that like that and that want that. Then on other examples, you might have a show that is pre-Watershed on BBC One, and you look at a joke, you go, actually, you know what, that's going to offend people, but in a bad way. And, you know, the point of this show is not really to offend people, and we're not looking to do that, so we're going to take that one out. But there are no set rules, really. You just sort of look at everything, and it's very murky waters, the waters of offence. And some people are going to get offended, whatever. And some of those people you have to ignore. And then if too many people get offended, you maybe have a think to yourself, and you think, actually, we've probably crossed the line with that one.
Do you ever have you ever had to apologise for something that you've put out or that you've pushed forward to go out that a lot of people have found offensive that you still probably don't find offensive because you obviously pushed it forward, so you wouldn't have done?
No. I can't think of a time. And I worked on a lot of shows, and a lot of which have had fairly strong content. Some of them have caused a minor amount of offence, and you get a handful of complaints. I've never had anything that's caused like a barrage of complaints.
The way that the society has changed in terms of PC culture, but also in terms of becoming more accepting of different groups of people. Yeah. Have you found that has changed how offence is being taken?
Yeah, I think society changes, and what people find acceptable and don't changes with it. And we obviously have to change with that. So yeah, there are things that you look at that were made in the 60s and 70s, and sometimes they make you wince, and you think, oh, we probably wouldn't do that today. But weirdly, it's not always the things that people think. So people always refer to things like, Alf Garnett, Till Death Us Do Part, and Sickness and in Health. And people use that as a barometer, saying, oh, you wouldn't get away with that today. Actually, I think you would. And I think, you know, Alf Garnett was an incredibly sharp comic creation, and you weren't watching him to agree with some of his views. He was a satirical character. It was satirizing a certain type of society. And I think something like that would be fine today, in the way that you might have, you know, David Brent 15 years ago said a lot of things that were un-PC, but you weren't ever supposed to be laughing with him, you were laughing at him. So I think that would be fine. But then there are certain things that were just, that you watch now, you know, that from 60s, 70s, even 80s, that make you feel uncomfortable because they were a product of their time, and they have certain things that feel instinctively, they feel racist, or they feel misogynistic, or they feel homophobic, and you think, you know what, we're not so comfortable with those views today because society has moved on, you know, in a good way, and so we probably wouldn't make that sort of comment anymore.
Definitely. I went down to a meeting about the BBC charter. You know, thing that's changed. I'll quickly explain what that is for anyone who doesn't know. Or do you want to do it?
No, go for it. Please.
Let's see if I get this
wrong. If you can explain to me, I'd love it.
As I understand it, it's every 10 years you guys have a review point with the government and internally to discuss the future of the programming for the BBC. Is that about right?
Yeah, very good. I think it's 11 years now.
Oh, was it 11
years? It was 10 years. Yeah, very good.
Okay, fair enough. I'll edit that. And what they said was, as you will know, I assume, is the new direction they want to go in is for fresh, innovative content, being more bold with content, and trying to make brands with more distinction within the channels.
Yeah, that's what the government said.
Yeah. How do you feel about that?
Yes, I agree with all that. We should be doing all of that, but it sort of comes with an assumption that we're not trying to do that. of course, everyone is always, you know, you have thousands of people at the BBC, and in fact, all television channels, constantly trying to come up with bold, original, new programming. It's not always easy, and you don't always get it right, but certainly we try to do that. It was like John Whittingdale stood up in the House of Commons and said, the BBC should make more shows like 40 Towers. As if we're all sitting here not trying to find a show that is going to go down in history as probably the greatest comedy show of all time. Of course we're trying to do that. But, you know, those shows don't come along very often. They're sort of once in a generation. And B, you always look back at stuff fondly. People, I think particularly with comedy, actually, more than any other genre, people are always very, very critical of what's going out at the moment, and always look back and go, oh, remember that time when Forty Towers was on and Porridge was on and Only Fools and Horses was on, conveniently forgetting all the terrible shows that were made then that have obviously been forgotten in the annals of history. And I look at all the shows, you know, even in recent history, you look at The Office and Gavin and Stacey and Miranda and Inbetweeners and Catastrophe and Fleabag and Mum. You know, there's some really great shows being made, you know, in the last 10, 15 years and on TV today. Peep Show, The Thick of It. I think these shows, you know, people will look back and remember fondly, but it's very easy to look at the current state of TV and be cynical about it and not. I guess it's always a golden age when you look back. It's never a golden age when you're in it, put it like that.
No, I think that's pretty reasonable.
And I'm not saying, by the way, that this will necessarily be looked at as a golden age, but I guess what I'm saying is I think people look at the bad and they don't look at the good.
Oh, for definite. I think you rose-colour stuff very easily.
Exactly, yeah.
Sorry, go on.
No, that's exactly that. So it sort of annoys me when John Whittingdale said that, because I thought it shows, I guess, a lack of knowledge and a lack of sort of appreciation about the industry and about, you know, what there's a lot of very, very talented comedy writers, very talented producers and directors out there making some brilliant stuff and trying to make brilliant stuff.
Do you think it's a case of, because he doesn't work in the same way you do in this industry, that he just, I mean, if he came in and followed you around for a day or a week or something, he might have a different perspective.
Absolutely. It's very easy to look at out from outside any industry and be critical of it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the main point of this podcast, is to let people see that you're not just like sitting
well, it's
there
great.
Going... Yeah.
I mean, it's the equivalent of me standing up and going, I think the government should make more money, should make the economy better. You know, it's easy. It's easy to say, isn't it? But it's not necessarily so easy to do.
Yeah. I mean... No, I can't think of anything else to say on that. If you're able to explain what BBC Studios is going to do next year in terms
of BBC Studios is...
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Basically, the new branding for BBC in-house production, and essentially we're becoming a commercial entity, so we're moving outside of the public license, so we won't be publicly funded by the license fee. We will be funded by the money that we make from the programmes that we make. So traditionally, we have always had a guaranteed number of hours called the in-house guarantee that we made at the BBC. That's disappearing. But in exchange for that, we are now able to make shows outside of the BBC. So we can go and make shows for ITV or Channel 4 or in America or whatever.
Do you want to? Are you able to talk about how your pitches are going to work next year in terms of out externally, like how you're going to look for programs to take to other channels rather than internally with people you kind of already know?
Yeah, I think in truth it will probably work exactly the same, in that we will be developing some comedy shows that we really love with some writers that we really believe in, and we will try and sell them, and you know, we will try and sell them to the BBC or we will try and sell them elsewhere. There's not a great amount of difference. I think, you know, maybe sometimes we will be able to develop a project that we will think, you know what, I couldn't think where that would sit on the BBC, but it's perfect for X channel over there. But in general, you know, the BBC has four channels with very different sort of remits. So it's hard to think of a type of show, type of comedy show, that wouldn't find a home somewhere on the BBC.
Would it just be a show then that you didn't have a slot for on the BBC that you would still want to get made?
Yeah, potentially. Or, you know, there will be shows that we will potentially develop specifically for Netflix or for Amazon or whatever. But yeah, I think the core part of our business, which is working with writers that we really like and getting scripts into a shape that we really love and we want to take out and sell to people, I think that will stay the same.
In terms of a sort of general theme that comes out of these podcasts, yeah, is the element of always looking for something new. And a lot of the time that sort of manifests itself in someone younger, yeah, in terms of an age demographic. And I wondered whether that is the case, or you feel like that's the case in terms of TV, whether if you're the young new face on the block in terms of a writer or a performer or whatever, it has an advantage in terms of that's something that works well in a visual medium simply because of how society and media works, or if it's a case of it doesn't make a difference and it's just whether it's funny.
Yeah, I think
or both.
I think whether it's funny, that's the only thing that matters. I mean, again, you look at Brendan O'Carroll, you know, has been doing that show for 20 years on stage before he had his sort of TV breakthrough. You know, Ricky Gervais wasn't, you know, a teenager when he came in. But then you've got the other end of the spectrum, I guess you've got the in-betweeners. They were all sort of relatively new, young faces on screen, although the guys that were writing it had, you know, worked in TV and been around for a while. I don't think anything matters other than, is it funny?
And in terms of selling, what's the hardest part of that for you?
Oh, I guess the hardest part is when you really believe in a project and the person you're selling to doesn't see that, and you just have to sort of swallow it and you know, until now, traditionally, if we've had a project turned down by the BBC, that's the end of the line for it, because we could only sell there. But I guess the advantage of being able to go to other channels and other broadcasters around the world is we can get a second chance at trying to sell stuff elsewhere.
Is that also the biggest logistical problem in terms of trying to get it made, or is that just the biggest problem in general?
What do you mean?
So you produce the show, so like, yeah, as in the script will come in, once, yeah, it's been commissioned, you'll, yeah, actually go out and make the set and the production, yeah, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there is a big problem in the logistical side as well as in the selling side itself that you particularly niggles at you or is annoying.
No, we never have enough money to make stuff. That's always the way. You know, budgets have been squeezed for years and years, so there's never enough money to match the ambitions of the scripts. But, you know, you do the best you can. And as I said, this is an amazing job and we're all incredibly lucky to be doing it. It's a real privilege to get to make comedy that you love. So can't complain too much.
What do you think's the biggest misconception of your job for someone who's outside of the business?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if people would know what my job was outside the business and what I do.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know.
Fair enough. What would you, if you knew you existed and,
yeah,
you weren't you,
yeah,
and you were looking in on the BBC, the hierarchy,
yeah,
what would you think your job is? Do you know what I mean? Like, if someone doesn't know and they just look at it and go, well, where does he fit into this?
No, I think, you know, I'm head of comedy at BBC Studios. I think once people know what BBC Studios is, in that we make shows, I think they probably pretty much know what my job was. I don't know. I don't think there are. I don't know.
No, fair enough. No, I always find it interesting what people perceive that the misconceptions are about what they do are.
Yeah.
Because generally speaking, like you said, if you've got an outsider view of, yeah, of that person or that industry,
yeah,
it can easily look like what you think they do is not what they actually do.
I think I do what people would think I would do. So I think it's all right on that front.
Okay, fair enough then. And when you're scouting for ideas,
yeah,
do you go to things like the Edinburgh Fringe or to comedy, yeah, clubs and things,
yeah,
like that?
Yeah.
What are you looking for in those situations?
Oh, God, it's impossible to say. You just look for something that excites you, you know, an interesting voice, type of joke you haven't heard before. I guess specifically for scripted comedy, when you're going to see stand-up, you think this is an amazing bit of stand-up, but what would be the script at the end of this? So you probably look for someone that tells interesting narratives, for an interesting character. I mean, for instance, you know, when I went to see Fleabag in Edinburgh, I think it was 3 years ago, and instantly saw that. I think within about 5 minutes, I thought this could be a brilliant TV series because she was doing a monologue. She was telling a story as a character. So the leap from what she was doing there to the final TV product was actually quite small.
Mm. And in terms of, like we were talking about, with the distinct branding for each of the channels, what would you, and obviously, like we said, it's not as science and it's not as easy as saying, we're just looking for this.
Yeah.
But what, how would you define the branding of each of the channels that you sell to in the BBC? And what would you say is what they're not looking for then? Because it would make it easier for people to know that channel definitely wouldn't put that on.
I never say that that's what they're not looking for, because it's too prescriptive. And as I said, you know, you need something that's going to surprise you. If you're ruling out everything that you don't think is right, then you're going to rule out all the things that would come along and surprise you. So I think that's quite a sort of unconstructive thing to do. Inconstructive? Unconstructive?
Non-constructive. Not constructive.
It's not a constructive thing to do. the only thing I say to people when they're like, firstly, when I'm talking to writers, I never tell them to think about the channels, because they have to write what they want to write. Let us as the producers worry about what channel is going to be the best fit for it. Just write what you want to write. But when I'm talking to producers and we're thinking about what channel we might pitch to, the only thing I say is just know the content on the channel, know what's on there. It's amazing how many people, you know, when I was in commissioning, how many production companies would come and pitch something, for instance, to BBC Three, and I'd be like, have you ever watched BBC Three? Because the show that you're pitching is currently on BBC Three. It's the exact same idea. So the only thing that to avoid as producers is don't pitch something that is the same as what they already have, you know, because they're not going to want it. They've already got it. But apart from that, I don't think anything should be off the menu. And in terms of channel identities, they're pretty obvious. And again, you just need to watch the channels to know what they are. I can't believe there would be that many people that watch television or interest in television that don't know what BBC One, BBC Two, BBC Three and BBC Four are. Would you say that's fair?
I think it's fair, but I think there's also very easy cliches that get chucked around about a channel. Or I mean, when I was talking to Julia McKenzie at radio, who was saying, you know, the cliche of the Radio 4 listener is nothing like the demographic that it brings in. And obviously it will vary from show to show as well, because you know, certain shows will bring in a certain demographic and it just carries on throughout the day. So, and also with technology in terms of podcasting for them, it means that, you know, it doesn't even matter if they're not available at the time slot they've got anymore. And I assume that's the same with you with TV, with the iPlayer. It means that if I'm not available at 6 o'clock when you put it on, I can watch it whenever I want. So I suppose I wondered if the identities were moulding or changing with technology, or whether that's just not having an impact on you at all.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I don't think at the moment, I think the channels still have, I would say, clear identities in terms of, if you switch on BBC One or BBC Two, you could sort of, you could tell the difference in the shows between them. Although having said that, you know, there's a lot of crossover between them, and successful shows like Miranda and The Office and The Great British Bake Off and The Apprentice that started on BBC Two then grew and you know, moved on to BBC One. Whether in the future, in 10, 20, 30 years, those channels will exist with those clear brand identities, I don't know. Because people do consume things in different ways. And it might be that, you know, you switch on your telly in 30 years and it's not a schedule, but there's, you know, just options. Do you want to watch some comedy? Do you want to watch some drama? Do you want to watch some documentaries? You know, and you watch things like that. But certainly at the moment, I would say, I think the channel identities are pretty clear and are hopefully alive and well.
Something I find really interesting is that when, so say you moved the show from BBC One to BBC Two for whatever reason.
Yeah.
It wouldn't tend to change the show too much in terms of, like, you'd be doing it because it need to move time slot or something like that, as I understand it. But when you move it from, like, BBC Two to iPlayer, it also doesn't change. But the way you watch it does. Because you'll often, I mean, if I'm on my laptop, I'm nearer the screen naturally, just even on that front.
Yeah.
Or it's later at night and it's not at the time you predicted it would be best for me to watch it.
Yeah.
So I wondered what your take on the way technology is affecting how people are consuming stuff is going.
Well, nothing moves from BBC Two to iPlayer. iPlayer is just obviously the catch-up service for BBC programming. So every program, and they do some original programming of their own, although it's quite a small amount of stuff at the moment. But every show that you watch on iPlayer pretty much is a BBC One show, a BBC Two show, a BBC Three show, or a BBC Four show. And in terms of how that changes, or how people watching stuff on catch up, I guess what your question is, does the fact that people often watch stuff on their phones now, does that change the type of shows that we make? Is that...
Pretty much.
Yeah. I would say a little bit for BBC Three, because obviously that is now an entirely digital channel. It is available on its, you know, on its web portal and on YouTube and on Facebook and other social media channels. And so we've made content on BBC Three is now, it's not, it doesn't have to be rigorously 30 minutes as it used to be. You know, something could deliver, Ep 1 could be 18 minutes, Ep 2 could be 24 minutes, Ep 3 could be 15 minutes. So we're not as rigorously tied into the durations that we used to be. And also, obviously, on BBC Three, they're making a lot of short-form content as well, which they didn't do before. But apart from that, at the moment, I wouldn't say that the change in technology is affecting us in scripted comedy too much. But it's something, obviously, we're incredibly mindful of. And if we don't start thinking about the way that people are consuming content, you know, we'll get lost.
Do you, and I don't know if you can't probably quote exact numbers, but do you know if people watch an episode of an average TV show more on demand than on, like, as in when it's showing naturally?
Well, it depends what show it is and on what channel and at what time.
Okay.
I mean, no, by and large, I would say, I don't know exact numbers, but I think catch-up is probably between 10 and 20% of viewing figures. So, and that, you know, that probably gets bigger as you go from BBC One to BBC Two to BBC Three. Say, take a BBC One comedy, you'll probably get, you know, you might get 3 million watching it live as it goes out, and then maybe an extra 500,000 to 1 million watching it on catch-up.
That's really interesting. I assumed it would be more like 50% or something higher, just because, like I said, of the convenience of it. And
yeah.
The fact that people watch stuff. I see it every day when I get on the train in the morning. Yeah. Everyone's not looking at people. Yeah. They're looking at their phone.
Yeah.
And it's fine because I'm not above it. But it's like, how, I just wonder how that's affecting society.
Well, I think maybe that, I don't know, maybe that's an age and demographic thing. I think, you know, the vast majority of TV viewers are over 50. And they're probably still watching, you know, a lot of them are still watching stuff on telly as it goes out. Also, I think there's still, you know, in lots of homes across the UK, there's still that lovely family experience of sitting down and watching a programme at 9 o'clock on BBC One as a family together. But yeah, I think it depends. But I think at the moment catch up is still a sort of relatively small amount. But obviously the longer something is on catch up, obviously that percentage is going to get higher and higher and higher. You know, something that was first broadcast 10 years ago, and if people have the chance to watch it on catch up over 10 years, the percentage of the people that watched it on the original broadcast is going to be smaller as a percentage of the whole, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a view I always tell people is a vanity figure, essentially, after, when it's online, because that's always going to go up. And it's a case of, you know, if you got 10,000 views over 20 years, not that many.
Exactly.
You know what
it's
I mean?
Exactly that.
But
exactly
it looks
that.
Really good if it just sort of appears there.
Exactly that, yeah.
Okay, so your investment in technology as the BBC is obviously, it keeps trying to stay up with people's trends and stuff, and that's obviously something, trend-wise, you would need to keep abreast with.
Yeah.
What kind of trends do you see happening in the next 1 to 5 years in terms of TV?
Oh, God, I just don't know. I mean, the honest answer is, in 5 years, I don't think TV will be hugely different from how it is now. You know, maybe there'll be a few little changes, but I think the changes that are happening will probably happen over a longer course of time, like 10, 20, 30 years. I think in 5 years, TV will be pretty similar. I mean, the trends at the moment are that a lot of money is going into drama, particularly a lot of film money. A lot of the big film talent, writing and directing, is moving into TV because that's where the money is. You have the big players on the market, the SVODs like Netflix and Amazon, the streaming services, who've come into the market, you know, very aggressively with a lot of money and you know, building their subscriber bases. But for us, we're still fighting our little corner, making, you know, comedy shows that we hope people in Britain will love. And I think in 5 years' time, we'll still be doing that.
What do you think of things like Netflix and I think Hulu?
I love Netflix.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I just, I'm, all right, in terms of Do you see it as a competition thing, or do you see it as a just a platform?
Well, I mean, as it, for the BBC in general, yeah, it's competition. For us as BBC Studios, as a production house, from next year, where we'll be able to sell to them, they're another broadcaster, so they're another means for us to, you know, another, hopefully another place that can give us money to make some comedy, another place for us to sell to. But no, I mean, in general, you know, I'm a lover of TV. I consume all sorts of TV on all sorts of platforms, and I think Netflix has some brilliant content. I mean, it's got some dodgy stuff as well, like everyone else, which, you know, thankfully they, or luckily for them, they get the chance to bury their stuff, whereas us at the BBC, you know, we make stuff, some of it turns out better than others, but we have to put everything out, so there's no hiding from the stuff that doesn't work, whereas Netflix can you know, bung it way down their list, same as Amazon. But you know it's great, and it's great that they're putting a lot of money into the market and making some great content.
My only problem with Netflix is the minute I log in, unless I know what I want to watch,
you get lost.
It's so overwhelming.
Yeah,
because it just goes, here's all our content, and you're like, I just wanted a curated feed.
Yeah.
I don't need this and stuff.
Well, it's quite rare, I would say, for me to just log on to Netflix and, you know, without a clue. You know, so much of, I would say, the way we consume stuff these days is done through word of mouth, because there's so much choice, there's so many options that you'd go mad otherwise. So what tends to happen is, you know, your friends on Facebook say, oh, have you seen The Crown? Or have you seen Westworld? Or whatever else is out at the moment, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. And if you haven't, you watch it, you know? So I go onto Netflix probably more often than not specifically to watch something.
Yeah, and in terms of word of mouth, obviously social media has got much bigger in the last couple of years. And what do you do in terms of, first of all, monitoring social media for your shows?
Yeah.
But also in terms of trying to find other shows that may, or other writers that maybe you're interested in?
Well, a lot of stuff. I mean, when most of our shows go out, I watch them pretty compulsively on Twitter. See what people. I think Twitter's usually a pretty good barometer of what people, whether people like stuff or don't. It used to be forums, but when people go on forums, it's because they have something to say. So it either means they're wildly positive or wildly negative. It doesn't feel like a very fair reflection. Whereas when people are on Twitter, they literally just tweet what they're thinking at any given moment. So you get quite a fair reflection of a show, I think, on Twitter, and you get some good instant feedback. We have a BBC Comedy Twitter feed and social media account, which is really useful for us to, you know, keep in touch with viewers and let them know about what we're doing. And then in terms of looking for writers, yeah, I mean, you never know, you might come across someone. I developed the first script of Catastrophe. When was that? Like, again, maybe, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, and knew nothing about Rob Delaney other than his Twitter feed. I followed him on Twitter and thought he was hilarious. So I thought, yeah, let's do a script with him. So yeah, it's a great new way for people to try out voices and characters and stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I find the problem. So my day job, I write jokes for Twitter for different brands and people and stuff. So that's why I always find social media really fascinating, because it's such a weird way of connecting with people.
Yeah.
And in many ways, I think it's replaced a lot of friendships for people. Like, because you can spend an hour watching someone's YouTube channel or something like that in place of meeting up with an actual person.
Yeah.
And you can just do it in your underwear at home. You don't have to actually go out.
Yeah.
You know, which
is.
I love it. I mean, I do it all the time.
Yeah.
So for me, it's kind of interesting that social media plays a part in your job in that way. And also, I read a really interesting article on, I think it was The Drum, where they were talking about the way people tweet during shows. And I remember I was doing, I can't name what channel it was, but I was working for them live tweeting during a show. And I kept having arguments with them saying that they wanted the show to trend during the time it was on. And I said, but then you're not watching the show.
Yeah.
You're watching the screen.
Yeah, yeah.
You
yeah.
want people to trend before and after, surely.
Yeah.
And I remember it was Inside Number 9. They did a track of how many people were talking during it.
Yeah.
And very few people were. But they
That's because they're engrossed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether this comes into your mind when you're selling it, whether you're like, oh, people are going to have loads of things to say about this, or
what? Nah, I promise you, I just don't think about stuff like that when selling stuff.
Okay.
I know it sounds boring, I just think about, is this funny? Is this a good, funny thing that I love?
Who do you think is the most underrated person in the television industry?
There's so many that don't get noticed. I think editors do an incredible job and rarely get talked about.
Okay. What is the most interesting thing you do that no one ever gets to see?
I think when I sit in the edit and look at the rushes of stuff, rushes are fascinating. You get to see all the different variations of actors' performances, and no one ever gets to see anything but the final cut.
Okay. And if you had one bit of advice for a writer who wanted to get something seen by the BBC that you haven't already said in this podcast, what would it be?
Get a good agent that loves your work and is brilliant at championing you.
Okay, cool. Thank you very much for coming.
No worries. Thank you. Cheers.
That was Chris. A shorter pod today than usual, but no means less informative. I loved his honesty and thoughts on the way the TV will stay pretty much the same in spite of the technological investments, as well as the way forward for the BBC studios, which is something I think more comedians and writers should really be keeping an eye on, even if they have little to no interest in writing for TV or getting on it in general. I just think the way that TV viewers and the way that people consume and see stuff, especially in comedy on TV, and how it trickles into the live viewers and the audiences that you get at gigs and at your shows, I just think it's very much worth keeping an eye on the developments on things like that. I'd just like to say a big, big thank you for Chris for taking part. And if you'd like to do the same thing, you can find all the links to his social media in my show notes or at my website, which is simonkane.co.uk. If you have a minute, it is, for me, amazing and humbling that busy industry people take the time to answer our questions. So do give him a shout out and say thank you if you appreciate or value any of the things that he said in this or any of the questions that you submitted that I managed to ask him. If you'd like to ask future guest questions, please join the Facebook group, which is called Ask the Industry Podcast, and it's on Facebook, obviously. If you'd like to support the show, please do consider sharing the link with someone that you think will get some value out of it, or subscribing in iTunes or YouTube. And if you'd like to give some sort of monetary donation, you can do that via PayPal on my website, which is simonkane.co.uk, or giving an ongoing donation via Patreon. Before I forget, quick plug for some of the things I'm working on personally outside of podcasting. If you are in Leicester and you would like to see a work in progress version of my new show, which is called Laughter is the Best Placebo, at 9 p.m. at The Exchange. It's a free show, so pay what you want on exit, and it would really be nice to meet some of you there. Also, the day before that, in Leicester, at Pat's Pizzeria, I'm doing our third live Q&A podcast with a bunch of Midlands promoters. So if you would like to come down to that, if you're a performer, a comedian, a person who wants to get into comedy, a person who wants to get into promoting, any of those things, please look up the details. They're in the Facebook group, and they're on my website. Please come down and support. Both of them are free entry, and the podcast one actually isn't a donation thing at all. So if you want to donate, you have to do it on my website. Additional to that, my LGBTQ night is running in London on the 12th of February at Angel Comedy Club, and there are still a few tickets left at the Bill Murray. So please come down if you can make it. Like I said, there aren't a massive amount of tickets left, but it would be great if it could sell out. So if you can afford £5 to come down and support that, that'd be great. If you want to know more about that night, check it out on my website. All the details are there. Thank you. If you've enjoyed this episode and you'd like to hear from more TV industry people, first of all, do give me some suggestions for who you think would be great in the podcast group. Also, if you scroll back, you can find an episode of Ian Coyle, who is the comedy commissioner at Dave TV, Graham Smith, who runs Grand Scheme Media, who are very similar to BBC Studios in terms of trying to get ideas off people and then package them up and sell them to different channels. Obviously, Grand Scheme are very different in terms of the operation and the way they work, but it's a very interesting parallel company to just look into if you're interested in anything that was talked about here. Just scroll back. If you can't find them for some reason, you can go to my website and there is a list on there. Just click the button that says TV People, and then they're all in one section that you can just scroll through and find. But for now, thank you very much for listening, thank you very much for sharing, and thank you very much for donating if you do, and I'll see you all in about 15 days' time. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.